Welcome back to our study of the Gospel of Luke. Welcome to all of you who are online. Glad to have you as well. We're speeding right along. See, what have we got tonight by way of review? What two things did Jesus give the 12 the ability to do when he sent them out? By the way, we're in chapter 9. This is Luke chapter 9 we're talking about. We were there last week, and here's the question for tonight's review. I'm sorry, somebody had a response? Authority to cast out demons, and what else? To heal the sick. Those are the two things he gave them the ability to do. What did he send them out to do specifically? What was his desire for them to do? To preach the good news of the kingdom of God. That's what he sent them out to do. And in order to give that message clout, he gave them those miraculous abilities. What were some of the instructions he gave them? I mean, you can look, it's okay. Right. If they didn't accept your message, knock the dust off your feet and leave that town. What else? Take nothing with you? Okay. Why would he say that, do you think? Everywhere you go, let the people support you. The people will support you. That's what he was telling them. Anything else? You can see what he said. Yes, if you find yourself welcome in a home, stay in that home and until you're done with your work there. This is from chapter 9 and verse 3. Take nothing for your journey, neither a staff nor a bag. Nor when he says bag, what do you think he means? The one who held the bag for the apostles was Judas, so he may be talking about money there. Nor bread, nor money, nor do not even have two tunics apiece. In other words, you're going to travel light. You're going to be going to stay and be cared for where you go. That's the idea. And anybody who doesn't receive you, move on. Move on and stay wherever you are received until you have finished your work. All right. What did Herod try to do when he heard what they were doing? What had he done? He had John the Baptist beheaded, and so he's thinking, is this John resurrected from the dead? Now, what might seem odd about him thinking that about John? Well, duh, yeah, he had killed him, so there's a resurrection. But had John ever done any miracles? See, Jesus is hearing about the miraculous things that these apostles are doing, but John had never done any miracles. And so there's a little something there to just think about and consider. Bud?
There's one place where John was questioned, and he said, I do no miracles.
Mm-hmm.
He was open and everything about it. Do you do any miracles? He says, I do no miracles.
And that same observation was made about John. Yeah. Even though he did no miracle, they still believed his message, which is definite inference that that's what the miracles were for, to encourage people to believe. So he wanted to see Jesus. Check it out. Verse 8, chapter 9, verse 8, by some that Elijah had appeared, by others that one of the prophets of old had risen again. And Herod said, I myself had John beheaded, but who is this man about whom I keep hearing such thing? And he kept trying to see him, kept trying to see Jesus. Not that he knew it was Jesus, but whoever's doing this, I want to see him. I want to see that that going on. What does the feeding of the 5,000 mean to you? I know that's an open-ended question. But the whole point of studying Luke's gospel is so that we will learn something that will impact our lives. What does Jesus feeding the 5,000 mean to you? What do you see in that that strikes you? What's that?
Compassion and love,
feeding people who are hungry. What else? God will always provide. He has the means to provide.
It says that there were 5,000 men, but
right.
There had to be women, children, more. So it was even more of a miracle that we let on.
Right. That's the expectation, that there were probably a bunch more than just 5,000 men. Well, 5,000 men, but a bunch more people, a bunch more mouths to feed is the idea. Anything else? Oh, where's that? Is Jamie, is that you?
Yeah, and so this is one of those verses I wish we had a little bit more.
Oh, yeah.
I've always tried to imagine, you know, how did you start out with five and then end up with 12 baskets, right?
Right.
It's like pulling the rabbit out of the hat and mm-hmm. pull it down below and keep pulling it out. Does it just magically apparate? Does everybody, you know, mysteriously have no hunger, but they get a crumb? You know, I've always wanted to see that particular miracle because it's a loaf of bread. You can break it up into a bunch of little pieces, but for everybody to get full from it, it's got to be created.
Right.
It's got to come about. And the astonishment and the awe of people seeing this creation, this instant, this thing, I think would have just been amazing.
If they were even fully aware, I don't know, you know, with 5,000 people, did they all know that they started with five loaves and a couple of fish?
Maybe not. And it may have been only the apostles that saw it was actually happening. But
right.
And Jesus may have just gone into a tent and just, you know, handed stuff out of the tent and kept it all secret. I don't know. But, you know, to see something so simple but so profound, I think would have moved a lot.
And I know this is, it's like almost a pointless, useless detail, but not really. I'd like to know, what was the quality of the food? I mean, if God is making this, because you've eaten bread that's, okay, I need to eat something, so I'll eat this. And you've also eaten bread that you go, wow, I want some more. Whatever it was, people didn't go away hungry, so it must have been good enough for them to eat to the point where they were filled, and the fish as well. What's that?
They wanted to do it again.
Yeah. They had another opportunity down the road. They're going to want to do it again. So, yeah, I'd like to know one more verse. It's not just me, see? Preston?
And you know, when you think about it, all the things that people have said, God knew that he had to take care of a certain need first so that he could help take care of their other needs, like which teach them the word and showing them. I don't know the connection, but talking about God's grace is sufficient. Whenever God told Paul had asked about a thorn in the flesh to have it removed, and God said, my grace is sufficient for you. So God knows what we need and when we need it. And yet he knew we needed feeding so that we could receive instruction from his son. So, I mean, he provides.
And he also didn't tell these folks, now y'all go home and just wait and there'll be food in your cabinet when you go look. He didn't do anything like that.
My mind goes back to where Jesus changed the water into wine.
Right.
The wine was the best, better than what was there. So that
And about 156 gallons.
Don't mean the taste.
Yeah, the taste, the quality of it.
That's where I'm going, yeah. The fish had that. I bet you they was good. I love fish.
I bet it was, yeah. Good fish is good fish. And some people think, well, there aren't any good fish. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Well, hey,
it's
free food.
It's free food, yeah. Oh, listen, I've had some free food that I wouldn't go back for. I've had some free food that I'd rather go find something to pay for. So, yeah, it's just free doesn't always mean good. Bud?
I think that number five up there, what does feeding of the 5,000 mean to you personally?
Mm-hmm.
I think we'd have to be pretty stupid not to look and see that you have an opportunity to exercise your faith. It's not a do you believe? No. Well, do you really believe? And so we have an opportunity to exercise our faith in Christ. And it's not a flip of the coin or something, but it is a real opportunity on my part, to exercise my faith in Christ. And you know what I'm saying? It's like you said. God doesn't test you, but He gives you an opportunity to be tested.
Well, He doesn't tempt us, but He'll let us be tested. And the test is the opportunity to do good.
It's just one of those things that you need to examine what you're looking at and say, all right, what do I see in this for me? You know, well, what does He expect from me?
I like it when something, we're told about something, but we're not told what to think about that. We're not given a list. Okay, here are the main points to learn from what you just read. We're just allowed to think for ourselves. What's that mean to me? And that's why I wanted to ask that question, because these things are supposed to mean something to me, supposed to mean something to you. And there's no list of right and wrongs. It's just let this sink into your heart and your mind. No.
Just for the apostles themselves to believe, you bring them along, keep their faith going, you know, like the waves and the wind. It's mm-hmm. for them, you know. This one here, and then, you know, he killed that fig tree that wasn't producing any fruit, and only those guys saw that. There might be some others. It's really just for them, and then subsequently us, for them to write down to us, for us to realize, wow, he's not just got power over demons, he's got power over the wind and the rain, he's got power over a fig tree dying, he's got power just to create food out of nothing. You know, it's just, I think it's for them and then subsequently for us. But.
And to, here's the thing about miracles. You read Genesis 1:1. In the beginning, God did what? He created the heavens and the earth. And then it says how He did it. He spoke everything into existence. How that works, I have no clue. The Hebrew writer says He made everything that is from things that do not appear. So He's got that kind of mastery to bring a physical universe into existence. And in this physical universe, there is space. As far as we know, there was never anything called space before. And this thing called time. He is in eternity, and He's created a universe in which there is time. I don't understand any of that, but I take it for granted that He did. And then here, all that focus comes down to this event where He's just quietly handing out bread and fish. And He has been in the boat, as you mentioned, where the winds and the waves, and it was boisterous and loud and scary, and He speaks, and everything goes calm. And in all of these situations, He's showing His mastery. And that's what I need to apply to my life. I know that to trust in God, who is the master of all things in all situations. But
I was going to say that Simon the sorcerer, you know, it said he was a sorcerer, so he was a pretty good magician. And but he knew that what the apostles were doing was not a trick. So what did he do? How did he respond? Well, he burned all his books. I mean, that's what they said.
Well, that was in Ephesus.
He responded
to the gospel. Right. He was a Samaritan who did that, but so did many other Samaritans believe and were baptized. So the gospel is powerful. And I think sometimes we sell it short. This is a living word, and it's changing our lives and the way we think. That's why we're here. All right, let's see what else we have. No more questions, but we got some reading to do. Let's start at chapter 9, verse 18. Yes?
We run off there, after he took up the 12 baskets of food, verse 18 to 21 is interesting to me, because come to pass and along praying with the disciples, it says, whom do the people say that I am? And answer said, some say John, some say Elijah, some say the prophets. And he said, but whom do you say I am? Peter said, thou art the Christ of God. And this is what confused me right here. And straightway he charged them and commanded them that they tell no one.
So right.
Here he's doing all these miracles and people are seeing this. And the disciples have been sent out. They come back. And now he's telling, don't tell anybody who I am.
Well, what happened in his own hometown?
Before the scribes and Pharisees, he's going to be crucified and raised on the third day. I see that power coming up here, you know. It's coming up in scriptures. But it's interesting that I'm doing all this, and people are following, and people are believing, and even Herod wondered who it is. And then he says, don't tell anybody who I am. Things coming after the fact. In fact, he's going to...
What that shows us is the impact of his identity on the culture. To me, he's saying, don't spread this around yet. And by the way, he's not in Jerusalem here. He's been in Capernaum, up around Galilee, and he's been in Bethsaida, and now he's still in that area, and he's saying, all right, who do people say that I am? And by the way, what did the people say? Who did the people say that he was? We're right here in this text. We were going to read this, but this, we'll just talk about it here. 9:18-22. Who did people say he was? John the Baptist. Was he John the Baptist? So if we were playing a game show, it'd be wrong. You get a little X, red X there. Okay, who else did they say he was? Elijah. Was he Elijah? No. Strike number two. All right, who else? One of the prophets. Was he one of the prophets? Yeah. All right, you're out. Who's next?
Were there any magicians other than what Christ was doing? Yes. They had seen other magicians, so they had something to compare it to. Yeah, I've seen that guy before. He's been on a YouTube show or something. He made that airplane just disappear.
But nobody's ever done anything like this.
That's what I'm saying. Nobody yeah. even has done anything like this. But see, they had something to compare it to.
Right.
In other words, they weren't just guessing and saying, I think he did it like this. No. They say, I don't know how he did it, but he did it.
And people are looking at him and saying, it's got to be Elijah, got to be John the Baptist, got to be one of the prophets. And they don't know. They aren't connecting the dots to say, this is the Christ, this is the Messiah. Some would ask later, well, when the Christ comes, will he do more miracles than this guy's doing? So that question's going to come up. But who does Jesus ask next about his identity? Peter. Who do you say that I am? What's Peter say? You're the Christ of God. So Christ, remember, Christ is not a name. Christ is a title. Anointed one, just like king is a title. Anointed one, Christ. What's the Hebrew equivalent of Christ? Messiah, same thing. Messiah, Christ, same thing. Two different languages. It means anointed of God. You are the anointed of God is what Peter is saying. And that's when Jesus warns him, don't tell this to anyone. And there's no verse right after that, Jamie, that says this is why he told them not to tell anybody. We just kind of have to think through that and figure it out on ourselves. My idea is that it... Remember when he was at the wedding feast in Cana and his mom came to him and said, hey, son, they have no wine. And what did he say? My time's not yet come. But what did he do? He did what his mommy said. By the way, she didn't even say it, did she? That's the power of a mom. Even Jesus does what mom says. What's that?
Mom power.
Mom power, yeah, mom power.
There is a verse right after the devil's flying that he said
that. Okay.
Yep. Saying the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised up on the third day.
Okay. So your application of that is?
Is that if they started telling right now, people are receptive of him.
Mm-hmm.
If everybody started finding out that he was the Messiah, what would they do? They would try to make him the king, like it happened in a different instance where
right.
they were trying to raise him up and make him the king.
And he just passed through the crowd.
But what was his purpose?
To do what he'd sent these guys out to do. Preach the kingdom of God. Eventually, to die, to pay for our entrance into the kingdom of God. But right now,
God always does what will save the most souls. And if he doesn't die and doesn't suffer, then what happens?
Nobody. Nobody will be saved. But everything in its right time. Everything is timed. Just like he said to his mom, it's not time yet. And Jesus could have allowed himself to be taken back in Nazareth. If all he needed to do was just come down here and let somebody kill him, that could have happened in Nazareth. But that wasn't the plan. There was another plan. A lot of other things had to be fulfilled that had been foretold. And so we're seeing it develop as we read it through. By the way, in verse 22, when he tells them this, this is the first time the gospel writers have it on record. The first instance when he tells them straightforwardly, this is what's going to happen to me. I'm going to be rejected, killed, raised up. And then he says in verse 23, if anyone wishes to come after me, what's he got to do? Take up his cross. How often? What does that mean to take up your cross? That means you're going to be crucified. You're going to die. That's what this is all about. I'm going to die for you. You have to die for me. And the way we die for him is to give our lives in service to him. And his promise is, you give yourself to me, I'll give you your life back and hundredfold. Charles?
Oh, something I always liked about that verse is that, you know, he doesn't say you got baptized and you're a member here now, and we're going to throw this cross on top of you and you're going to have to learn how to drag it.
Right.
I like that it's a daily choice.
What's the point of what he says? Put it in your own words. Is he talking about you got a toothache and that's your cross to bear? Is that what he's talking about? Is he talking about your job doesn't pay much and that's your cross to bear? Is he saying your neighbor's dog barks a lot and that's your cross to bear? Is that the kind of thing he's talking about? No. Taking up your cross means you're going to die. That's what it meant when Jesus carried his cross. When he bore the cross, that means he was dying. And that's what it means for us. Well, his wasn't, that's for sure. Billy?
For example on this, when I first became a Christian, my family turned their back on me.
Okay.
That's a hard burden to carry. You know, you're alone, you wonder why. And you think, but then I realized later through the scriptures that I had mothers and brothers and brothers in Christ and sisters in Christ and aunts and uncles and grandmas, far beyond the just two family members I had.
He says a great many things that have to do with these kinds of relationships. He said, if you come after me and you don't hate your father and your mother, well, wait a minute, are you supposed to hate your father and your mother? But he's talking about the relationship that we have with him, and somehow there's this extremity of you so love Christ that anybody else who tries to come in his place, you're not going to have that. You're going to allow that. He said, I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. And the sword he's talking about is a sword that comes between our family members who do not believe in him as the Messiah. So he's saying, don't be spreading the word around yet. He doesn't say yet, but that's the emphasis. Don't be spreading the word around yet that I am the Christ, the Messiah. But he's still going around the countryside, as has been pointed out, doing all the things that prove him to be the Messiah. And people are questioning his identity. Who is this guy? Is this Elijah? Is this John the Baptist? Just one of the prophets? And they are all wrong. People are still wrong. I don't watch them. When you say, we're going to have a show on TV. It talks about the life of Christ. I'm not going to watch it. Because you're going to get a bunch of experts on there that don't even believe he was the Son of God. And I'm going to watch that stuff. It's going to be your view and your interpretation of about Jesus. No. He's the Messiah. He's the creator. He's the one who spoke everything into existence. He's the one who owns the universe because he created the universe and has perfect love for everybody in the universe. And those aren't the kinds of things you hear on those programs. All right, where are we here? Verse 25, what's a man profited if he gains the whole world and loses or forfeits himself? That's a good question. But while you are gaining the world, it sure looks like a good deal. While you're making the money and having the fun and going on the vacations and acquiring the boats and the motorcycles and whatever else you can get your hands on, and you don't have to be rich for that to be an issue. You can be poor as a church mouse, and these things can still take the same focus in your life that they take. As a matter of fact, if you've got money, what I've found a lot of times with people who have money and spend their money on things like this, they're the ones who finally realize there's nothing in this. They know by experience.
They come to the same conclusion Solomon did.
Right, exactly. Hear the conclusion of the matter. The whole of man is fear God, keep his commandments. Nothing better than that. And I remember hearing a man make that observation because he had looked into the lives of famous people, wealthy people, popular people who had everything. And you can just go home tonight and Google famous people who killed themselves. It's not when you're poor and in the gutter that you find out there's nothing to life. It's when you have everything this life has to offer and you get there to the top of the ladder of success and you find out there's nothing. That's when you have this sense of emptiness, unless. What phrase did Solomon keep repeating in Ecclesiastes? Vanity. Vanity of vanity. All is vanity. If you don't have God, everything is empty, everything is vain, your life is coming to nothing. No matter how much you acquire in life, no matter how much you accomplish in life, you're coming to nothing if you don't have God. If you do have God, you don't need anything else. On Judgment Day, when Jesus comes back, that's the only thing that's going to matter. You got a relationship with him? That's all that's going to matter.
It's kind of like the prayer that you gave at the beginning of the class. You were talking about God, maybe we need to pray for you, you know, and you referenced that, and then you've given us, I'm trying to remember, I can't remember exactly what you said, but something to the effect that you've given us the opportunity to do good, and us the right to choose that, you know, and it makes you think about all these things that we're talking about in relationship to that. You know, we have the whole duty of man, we have this opportunity to do good or not to do good, to serve God or not to serve God. You know, it just kind of comes down to that.
Now look at these crowds, 5,000 men there eating the fish and the bread along with the whoever else was there, women, children. And there's only 12 apostles, and these are the guys who are they're on the in crowd. But the message of the gospel is going out to everybody, so everybody has the opportunity to believe and embrace the gospel and embrace Jesus as the Messiah. But it's a very limited number who do, and that's why Jesus says there's a broad way and there's a narrow way. And what about that narrow way? Who finds it? Few. Few find it. Few find it. And if you're like me, you found it, but you still question, am I really right? Yeah. From time to time, you got to look at yourself and go, am I doing this right? Probably nobody else in here does that but me, but anyway. All right.
Do you think Satan plays a part in our doubting and even in our worthiness?
Oh, yeah.
He's very cunning, and I think we forget that. There's things that we question, and I think we don't always, I don't want to say give him the credit, but Satan is very cunning.
Does anybody else remember things from your childhood when you did things that were just wrong? And you it takes you a while to get the presence of mind to go, I was six. Why do I still hold myself accountable for things I did when I was 6 years old or 13 years old, when I played marbles and took Charlie Gooderham's marbles? And I was a good marble player. That's what happens to you, though. When you're good at something, you might just wind up doing something you regret for the rest of your life.
I'm not sure it's all those things so much. It's the ones we wrestle with daily.
Right.
Romans 7, why do I do the things I don't want to do?
Yeah. And see, this is our issue. We've got this before us all the time.
You constantly run to him and talk to him about him, and you're in front of this holy and perfect God, you're saying, here I am again.
Me again, Lord. That's our lot in life. And so we keep reading this and seeing he's dealing with people who are just like us, and he's not dealing with them as if it's some kind of a religious business proposition. He's dealing with them as he is the good shepherd bringing his sheep into the fold. Look what he says here in the last part of, well, not the last part of verse 9, but the last part of this section. Verse 26, whoever's ashamed of me and my words, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his glory and the glory of the Father and of the holy angels. But I say to you truthfully, there are some of those standing here who will not taste death until they see the kingdom of God. Well, what does that mean? And then it says in verse 28, some 8 days after these sayings. So how long? A little over a week. Time reference. What had Luke said at the beginning? I did my research to find out the consecutive nature, the chronological nature of these things, and that's what he's doing for us here. Some 8 days after these sayings, he took along Peter, John, and James, went up on the mountain to pray. And he does this a couple of other times. He takes these three guys, takes them apart from the other apostles. What do you think the other apostles are thinking? I don't know. It doesn't say. Just human nature. Oh, there he goes again. Peter, James, and John. Peter, James, and John. What's wrong with us? Because they're going to be fussing over who's the greatest in the kingdom. That's what they do. Because they're just like me. He took along Peter and John and James, and he went up on the mountain to pray. While he was praying, the appearance of his face became different, and his clothing became white and gleaming. Behold, two men were talking with him, and they were Moses and Elijah, who, appearing in glory, were speaking of his departure, which he was about to accomplish at Jerusalem. Wouldn't you like to have been in on that conversation? Know what they were saying to one another. Peter and his companions had been overcome with sleep, but when they were fully awake, they saw his glory and the two men standing with him. And as these were leaving him, Peter said to Jesus, Master, it's good for us to be here. What's his suggestion? Let's make three tabernacles. Essentially three shrines, three ways to say that we honor the presence of these three great men. One for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. And then what does Luke say? Not realizing what he was saying. What does that mean? He spoke before he thought. And could he even be aware? I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but has anyone else in here ever spoke before you thought? Okay. You've seen that thing where somebody says, you know that filter thing you have to keep you from saying things that you shouldn't say? Well, I don't have that. That seemed to be Peter. And it's interesting, this human trait of his, sometimes it's a good thing, sometimes it's not such a good thing. Can you remember a time when it was a good thing? What did he say when he saw Jesus on the water? He said, command me to come to you. And the rest of the apostles said, "I'll see what happens." And Jesus did. Come on, come on. Jesus could have said, "No, you'll get out here and lose faith, and you'll get out. I'll pull you out." No, he said, "Come on," and he did, and he walked on water. None of the other apostles apparently did that, but Peter did. So he's the only guy that ever walked on water. And here he's opening his mouth again. We haven't read it yet from Luke's gospel, but you remember what happened when they came to the empty tomb. Who got there first? John was faster, so he got there first. What'd John do? He stopped outside and looked inside. And Peter shot right in there, not waiting on anybody. So this is Peter, and he says, "Here's what we're going to do. Make three tabernacles." And Luke says he did not realize what he was saying. While he was saying this, a cloud formed and began to overshadow them. We know clouds in Oklahoma, don't we? It doesn't sound like this was way up there. It sounds like this was pretty close. And it overshadowed them. And they were afraid as they did what? Entered the cloud. So however high it was when it formed, it was down to them in their presence. What does this remind you of anything? Oh, I'm sorry, Jamie.
So why is it there he did not know what he was saying? Why is it a bad thing that he saw, we need to build shelter for them, not knowing how long they're going to stay, all these things? Why is it bad that he offered that?
Any speculation as to why that was not a good thing? BJ?
It seemed like the cloud got there because it was like, that's not the point. The point of whatever wasn't to have shrines. It was just conveying a message from them to Jesus. And it's like, y'all are losing the point or about what this is going on, is what it seemed to be about.
My translation, let us put up three shelters, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah.
It's not bad, but you realize Moses and Elijah's already gone. They want them to hear God, Christ. And the voice from heaven, a couple of verses later, says, "This is my beloved son, hear ye him." This is who it's all about. Now, Moses and Elijah was there, but they don't need to be acknowledged as a sacrifice or temple, because Christ is our temple and he's our sacrifice.
Now, it doesn't say this in the text, but if you, how many of you have been to Jerusalem, specifically Jerusalem? Anybody? You go to Jerusalem, there's a lot of things that have been marked out, primarily by the Catholic Church, saying this is the exact spot, this is the stone, this is the place. And when you have something like that, you have people coming from all over the world to do what? To focus on the spot and venerate the spot. It's when you watch it, it looks exactly like you would expect what people would do when they worship idols. They're bowing down on their knees and they're kissing whatever's on the ground. And you're doing your research thinking, okay, we don't even know for sure this is the stone or this is the place, but that's the way people treat this. And so how many of those kinds of places has God marked out in the Bible for us? Not a one. Not a one.
I'm going to say that, and of course I may be talking out of place, but Peter did not run into the tomb when we asked ourselves why.
John didn't. Peter did.
John did, but Peter ducked down and he looked in, but he didn't go in. So someone says, why? They asked the question, why didn't he go in the tomb? Just run on in there. They say he was looking for a cloth where that the man, it said Jesus, it was a habit when you finished a meal, you took your napkin and stuff and laid it over to the side to tell your servant, that's the end of it. I'm through eating. Okay. Well, what happened was, when he looked in there, he saw the napkin and everything laying on the bed. That was a signal that he was through. This was the end. I'm through eating, you know. In other words, servant, look at the signal. Hey, I'm through eating.
Yep.
So they observed the ritual of that particular time and place. That was the end of it.
But it could be, but there's nothing in the text about that. It would just be conjecture. But when I read this, I'm thinking, of all the places that God could have said, here's a special place, go here to worship, there aren't any places like that. When God was speaking through Moses in Deuteronomy, he said, there's going to be a place where I'm going to put my name. And that place we now know was Jerusalem. They came to Jerusalem. God put his name there. That's where the tabernacle was set up, because it was the tabernacle initially. Who decided there ought to be a temple? David. That was David's idea. And David said, I want to build you a house. I'm living in a really nice house. I want to build you a house. And what did God say? I'm going to build you a house. And he wasn't talking about a place for his body to live. He was talking about the name, the house of David, that he was going to build, and he did build through him. And the one who sat upon his throne was of his lineage, who was the Christ. And that's the house that God was talking about. But God said, okay, go ahead and build me a temple. So built a temple. And later on, when you're reading, after Nebuchadnezzar came, you read where God said, I'm taking my name away. The 9th chapter of Ezekiel, you can, well, go to Ezekiel 9. We're in the closing moments of our class tonight. Ezekiel was the prophet who was sent to be among the exiles in Babylon. And he gives us this view of what happened with Nebuchadnezzar. God brought Nebuchadnezzar into Jerusalem. Same Jerusalem that we're reading about here in Luke. Ezekiel 9. He cried out in my hearing with a loud voice, saying, draw near, O executioners of the city, each with his destroying weapon in his hand. Behold, 6 men came in the direction of the upper gate, which faces north, each with his shattering weapon in his hand. And among them was a certain man clothed in linen, the writing case at his loins. And they came in and went and stood beside the bronze altar. Where's the bronze altar? It's in the temple. Then the glory of the Lord of God of Israel went up from the cherub on which it had been, to the threshold of the temple. And he called to the man clothed in linen, at whose loins was the writing case. And the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, even through the midst of Jerusalem. Put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and groan over all the abominations which are being committed in its midst. But to the others he said in my hearing, go through the city after him and strike. Do not let your eye have pity, and do not spare. Utterly slay old men, young men, maidens, little children, and women, but do not touch any man on whom is the mark. But now where has God gone? It came up from, look where it says there, from the cherub on which it had, where are the cherub? They're on the mercy seat. So the glory of God is pictured in this vision as being at the mercy seat. And where does it go? It goes to the threshold of the temple. What's the threshold? That's the doorway. It's as if God's getting ready to leave, and that's exactly what he does. You get to chapter 10, verse 18. The glory of the Lord departed from the threshold of the temple, stood over the cherubim. And so we're seeing God on this transfiguration mountain come down in a cloud around the apostles. He also did that same kind of a thing when the tabernacle was originally finished in the last chapter of Exodus. The cloud filled the tabernacle, and Moses and everybody had to get out of Dodge because they couldn't stand to be in there. And now we're seeing the same kind of thing again here. Jamie?
So to go back to my original question, I've looked at a couple different translations. I see tabernacle, shelter, and tent. And I'm wondering if it is the same word they used for tabernacle in the Old Testament. Because when I'm initially reading this, I'm understanding he sees 3 people, they're talking to Jesus. Oh, I need to make sure they've got a leaf over their head, keep them from getting wet. I'm not seeing that he's wanting to build altars in this location as a place of remembrance and memorial for this transfiguration
right.
moment. So I don't understand why it's saying not knowing what he said.
Right.
It sounds more like he's wanting to honor each one of them with something.
Yes.
Because if it was a shelter, it would be just one shelter. To
right. We'll just build a big one for all three of you to get in, because you want to talk together anyway. Like what? Right. So what does God say when he speaks? This is my beloved son. Do what? Hear ye him. I've already sent Moses. He brought the law. You heard the law. The law's done with. I sent my prophet Elijah to try to turn them back from their evil, and they didn't listen to Elijah. Now I've sent my son. Hebrews starts out the same way, the letter to the church at Hebrews. God, who in times past in various manners spoke to the fathers by the prophets, hath in these last days done what? Spoken to us by his son, by whom he made the worlds. So we've got this, and now we've got this. And Charles has got a hand up. Before we leave.
Sorry, I have the bell, so I can, anyway.
You got his finger on the power.
I like what Don was saying. I don't see anywhere in here where Peter misspoke or said something wrong or where he was rebuked. But I've met Jewish people in the past today, and I think a lot of Jewish people back then, who revered Jesus and Moses and Elijah as prophets,
mm-hmm.
as equals. And I think Peter, like I said, didn't do anything wrong. He just wasn't thinking. And he said, I can't believe I got to see these great and powerful, these three men of God together. Let's get them something to cover them, to help them. And then, God doesn't respond with a rebuke. He shows up in verse 35, and he doesn't say, don't do what you're about to do. He just says, this is my son, my chosen one. Listen to him.
Right.
So I don't think Peter did anything wrong. I just think, God literally came down and said, you're paying attention to three people. The point is, those two guys were talking to me. They were talking to my son, and they were talking to me. And I want you to pay attention to me.
Right.
They are there to draw attention to me.
But previously he had said, you are God's son. So he knew, and so he was putting it on equal level at that point, and that's why they said they're probably he misspoke, because he already knew Jesus was God's son.
Right.
And that he was better than, more.
But he opened his mouth again, yeah. Didn't he? Yeah.
I was at the understanding, felt like he was talking about altars, so he could just worship this one and this one, honor them some way. You mentioned a while ago,
right? Like Don was saying, seeing them all three is equal.
Yeah, together. And I had the impression that he said, "Wow, we've got these three here. Let's do this, this, and this. Let's fix them up something to honor them." And,
when you look at the circumstances, there's Jesus. His clothing has changed. His face has changed. Something's going on here that you don't know what's happening. It might be a good idea to keep your mouth shut, Peter. No, I don't. What's that? He was impulsive. I really think he had the best thing at heart, but it's just like a kid. Just like a kid. He gets overwhelmed with excitement, enthusiasm, and if you're a little more mature, you'll say, I'm just going to, this isn't my party. I'm just going to sit here and be quiet and see what the Lord's got to say. Just like Luke didn't record it, but we just read where Jesus told him the first time, I'm going to be arrested, crucified, and raised on the third day. When Matthew records that, what does Matthew tell us Peter's response was? Ain't no way long as I'm around here. And what did Jesus tell him at that point? That's when he said, get behind me, Satan. You do not relish the things of God, but the things of men. And it sounds like that's the same kind of thing he's doing here. He's thinking about the things of men. Don, and then Bruce. We'll get this straightened out.
Not only was he saying he's greater, but they just got this saying, some of you won't taste this till you see the kingdom come. And so comes. You got to listen to him. He's ushering in the new covenant. The kingdom is coming. You know, it's going to be different from these guys. You know?
Right.
So it might be part of it too.
Very, very different and on a much higher level.
And you talk about it being responsible and duties and kind of for the moment. Look what he did to the centurion when he came to get Jesus. He cut his head off, trying to cut his head off.
Now tell me he wasn't being courageous. And Jesus did not say, all right, you goofball, you can't be my apostle anymore. As a matter of fact, Peter's the one who opens things up on Pentecost. He's the one who stands up with the 11 and preaches that sermon that we read about where 3,000 people responded and said, men and brethren, what are we going to do? We believe what Peter said. And then he goes on. He's imprisoned and God sends an angel to set him free. He's the one who says, no other name given among men whereby we must be saved. And it's Peter all the way up into chapter 12. And then Paul is converted in chapter 9 and picks up with his work in chapter 14. First Gentiles coming into the kingdom. That's Peter sent to do that. All this stuff. All right.
With his denials and what happened.
Yeah.
Change.
He's a unique fella, and God used him. What's that?
It's like they were asleep just before he was going to be crucified. They were asleep then, too, just before that happened. They woke up and saw all three there.
Now, next week,
falling asleep.
let's get the discussion developed this fiery at the beginning next week, so when the bell rings, we can turn you loose. I enjoy this. I love you guys. Appreciate you. Class is dismissed.